Today's program has been brought to you by Kane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit Kane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. First of all, we might as well give a shout-out to Ben of Cookies Band, since compliments were being had here in the studio. And who do I have in the studio but Julia Tertian and Cleo Brock Abraham of Weird and Ravenous. The Weird and Ravenous thing.
Mm-hmm.
The epitome of that name, first of all. Where did it come from? It's such an intriguing thing in and of itself.
It was how long ago? Like 2 years ago?
2 years, yeah.
Cleo and I have been very fortunate to go on a number of vacations to Martha's Vineyard. And when we're there, we just basically cook and eat the whole time.
Pretty much.
And playing some cards in between. And we were talking about, we met working together a really long time ago. And we were talking about figuring out ways to work together more, and then all based around food. And then it was like this fun conversation of what we would call ourselves. And then we were trying to describe who we are, I guess, individually and together. And we decided we're really just weird and ravenous, and it stuck.
Pretty much, yeah.
Everyone except for my mother loves it.
I know. So, I think it's great.
But I think she's into. I think it's
great. She's coming out. Yeah, coming around.
Yeah.
Martha's Vineyard. That's a wonderful place to kind of. To situate yourself, cook, and you know, ponder.
Yes.
Was it intentional, or do you guys have an attachment to that place?
We've started going up there, I think, 3 or 4 years
yeah,
ago.
Something like that.
My mom's friend has this little cabin near Menemsha Pond, and we've just been trying to get up there as much as possible. And we love it.
And we have a running joke about that. Being there, we sort of hate seeing people who just arrived like for the first time and have no attachment to the area because it's so special, but we only just started going in our adult
yeah,
lives.
Yeah, we like to think that we've been going there our whole lives.
So we do a lot of lying about
I'm that way
growing locals.
Up there. Yeah, I'm that way with Northern Michigan.
Okay, right.
But they call you fudgies if you live in another part of Michigan or the Midwest and come up there because it's a big fudge community, fudge-making community.
Is that where Mario Batali has his?
He does, Northport. I've not seen him up there, but I have seen his Crocs at the base of Sleeping Bear Dunes one time. He's large.
So, like, Mario was here.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, who else has giant, like, orange Crocs in northern Michigan? And we're like, no way, that's Mario. And then the next day, he was on Good Morning America, being like, Sleeping Bear Dunes is my favorite place on Earth. Like, oh, my God. Yes, he is rife up in northern Michigan.
Beautiful he loves it
place.
There.
Yeah. Well, the reason I think I was asking about Martha's Vineyard is because what you two try to do with Weird and Ravenous, as well as Make Mondays Better, one of the many projects underneath that website, is try to find a place, a time, and you know, someone else, you know, a loved one or a community to cook for and make cooking a part of their lives in a way that it wasn't before, you know, be it intrinsic or be it inherent, it's a very, very important part of your lives and whoever else you bring in.
Yeah, this started. It's a very eloquent way.
Yeah. Well, this started a long, long time ago because I love the pictures you two have on the website.
Oh, thanks.
Playing towards grandparents.
Oh,
tell me a little bit about each picture.
Oh, that was such a sweet thing because there's a So the story behind the picture of me was, I don't know how old I was, like 3 or 4 or something. And
no, you were 8.
I was 8?
Yes.
You were clearly so 8.
Let's call it 6.
And it changes every time you tell the story, too.
But we've been going to the vineyard since we were 3.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Oh, yeah. Since we were 3. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We've been somewhere there. Yeah.
But anyway, I was a kid. I was a young kid in the picture. And I, the picture takes place in North Miami Beach, where my great-grandmother used to live. And I was lucky to know her for a while before she passed away. And when my brother and I, and also when my cousins, this is all my dad's side, when we would go visit, it was the rule that any kids visiting the great grandparents had to do some kind of like performance or put on a show. So my cousins, my brother, they all like sang their songs from camp, or, you know, did some, maybe juggled something or whatever their trick was. And I decided I would teach this group of like, I don't know, 3 or 4 of these like 85-year-old women. I would give them a cooking lesson, and I thought it would be great to teach them how to make a fruit salad, because maybe they didn't know how. So
or had forgotten.
Yeah, exactly. So that is, so the picture of me is, you know, being with my extended family cooking at a really young age, and then
giving a demonstration.
And lifelong micromanager. Yeah. And then when we wanted to put together our site, we thought, you know, like people were like, oh, you should put a picture of you guys. And okay. I was like, I'd rather put this one. Like, that's way more fun. And then all of a sudden, Cleo came up with this picture of her when she's about the same age, baking at her grandmother's house.
Right, so. Which was always a special time for me, too. So it just felt really, really fun in a different way to sort of do a biopic, so to speak.
Why were you emphatic about food? I know food television was kind of in both of your lives, mm-hmm. whether or not just as a viewer or interacting with it. Mm-hmm. But did you always want to go in food? Did you know from that 4 through 8 year old self?
I feel like I knew like before then, and I really just can't remember not being into cooking. And not just food, but also sort of food media. And I grew up with parents who were in the magazine business. And when I was really little, my favorite game was to play photo shoot when I would take, for example, my fruit salad, and I would
not precocious at all.
No. And I would arrange it, and I had this Polaroid camera that I loved, and I would set up the whole thing, and I had this, like, I remember this little lamp in my room, and I would like move it so I could get the right light on it. And but I always loved food and anything on television about food or written about food, and I would fall asleep reading cookbooks. And and that's been my whole life. There is not, I can't like go back to one point when it just all happened or came together. It's just always been my thread.
And Cleo, am I wrong in saying via IMDb that you were in the Babysitter's Club?
Oh no, yes.
Okay.
Guilty. Well, I still get residuals.
Really?
Yeah, isn't that amazing? That's, I still awesome. Get residuals for $7 sometimes, $15, which I always find, I mean, can you imagine how much Tom Hanks gets? I
mean, yeah.
Amazing. If I get $15 all these years later.
But that's you know, there's arts and entertainment, there's culinary arts and entertainment. But the performative aspect of what, you know, Julia was doing in front of her octogenarians, or however you say that, fancy 80-year-old
yeah,
world.
Getting paid big
yeah.
bucks.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, yeah.
Did you want to be in front of the camera? Did you want to be entertaining in that fashion?
Yeah, it's definitely something that's, you know, I was a big theater nerd, and it was something that I flirted with for a really long time. I'm from Los Angeles, so it's one of those things that it's in...
It's ingrained.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty much in your blood. And so I... Definitely was something that was part of my growing up. And then, of course, I was just always a complete lover of food. I've always said I have heightened taste buds, which I think is a condition. I'm not sure.
Oh, an actual physical heightened taste bud.
Exactly, where I can't actually get through a meal without, and much to some of my friends' horror. So, yeah, it's just something that I've, you know, I've always loved to eat, always... I didn't really come into cooking until college, when I started doing these big turkey dinners, Thanksgiving dinners for all of our friends. And then, of course, I met Julia, and we are shared love of food became such a big part of our friendship. And
well, let's talk about that instant. Let's talk about, you know, timed well with Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Those turkey dinners and that felicitous moment where the two of you met.
It was a sunny day.
We were in Martha's Vineyard.
We were in Martha's, where we go every summer.
We're our grandparents. Together,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. Where our grandparents founded it,
exactly.
I think.
My grandmother is Martha.
No, we met in working in London, and it was a very close working environment. We did not meet in London.
We met before that.
We met in one summer working in Amagansett, and I was on a big workout kick that summer, so I was in my workout clothes, and Julia came in to start cooking for a week that summer, and for some reason I thought Julia was like 10 or 15 years older than me. And then I said, oh, what year did you graduate from college? And she said, 07. I said, oh, yeah, me too. Okay, cool. And then we didn't have an in-between getting to know you phase.
There was no meeting Cleo and then figuring out, like, a long time later, like, oh, I've got this great best friend. It was just like...
Yeah, we became best friends pretty... instantaneously.
Yeah, and the circumstances of us working together, we were both working for the same person, and Cleo was working on a website and I was working on a book, and it involved a lot of traveling and being together in different places, and so I think you know, it was sort of the kind of moment where for our working and our personal relationship, it was kind of like sink or swim, because you're going to spend all this time together.
Yeah, exactly. You better love that person. And luckily we did.
And and that was that. And
and a lot of time at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
If you can get through Whole Foods, it's sort of like IKEA.
Around the world.
If you can get through, like, you know, Whole Foods or IKEA with someone, then...
you're good.
Yeah.
But we, being in these different places and working on all these different projects at the same time, I think... you know, cooking was this really great way for us to like spend time with each other, not working, and just relaxing. And then also a great way to in London, Cleo's boyfriend is British and had this like wonderful group of friends there, and like we could invite them over. And
one of my favorite meals we did in London was we decided we should do a sort of a cooking challenge for ourselves, and we decided we would try to do the whole dinner for how many people? 8 people?
Yeah, it was a pretty big group. Something
for
like
under
that.
20 pounds.
Which was like maybe like...
$30.
Yeah.
We did it.
We totally did it.
Amazing Brazilian...
beer included.
Yeah, beer included. We did a delicious Brazilian feijoada with farofa and rice. And
it was really... it's also like... it was a great way to like... I think cooking in different places is a great way to get to know the places, because we went just to the normal grocery store to get like black beans and all that kind of stuff. But then we like found some, Cleo kept telling me about farofa, which I had no idea what it was before then, which is, what is
I
it?
I love farofa. Like, it's a toasted,
explain, yeah.
It's a toasted flour. And it has just the best, it kind of has this crunchy texture.
It's almost like seasoned breadcrumbs.
Yeah.
But like a little finer.
But much finer, yeah. And it's something that's always served with traditional Brazilian meat stew, which is what feijoada is.
So we like tracked down some like Brazilian restaurant and like bought like a little container from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're sort of like zigzagging around London getting these Brazilian ingredients.
And one of my favorite things, which is pão de queijo. Which are those cheese balls.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which are delicious.
We made them?
Yeah.
Did we? Oh.
Yeah. So that was a fun. And it was all for under $35.
Yeah, and it was great. And it's just, I mean, yeah, I think cooking for people is the best way to invite them into your home, wherever that might be, or however temporary that space is. And it's a good way to make it your home. And we were sort of like... in these funny working conditions of...
that often feels sort of transient.
Yeah, and so it was nice to just make it feel really, like, warm and
Yeah. See, mm-hmm. there's where you first start seeing the ingenuity and yeah. production value of what mm-hmm. you do now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of putting challenges forth upon yourself yeah. and those solutions, because we'll come back after the break and talk about, you know, the very charming, quirky ideas you have for Food 52 mm. and other outlets. But it's obviously, you know, they're collaborating, cooking yeah. together, and, you know, having fun. I mean, that's
always
the core of everything. And this linchpin, this person that you're talking about that you both work for, people do know who she is, and you can mention the name.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to leave it hanging then.
When we come back,
we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
Okay. First of all, now I'm worried that that's going to seem like we don't want to take.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We were just talking about speech impediments and
yes.
such. And luckily we have Julia, who is a woman enough to pronounce this name for us.
So Cleo and I met, we were both working for Gwyneth Paltrow a while ago, and Cleo worked with her when she started Goop, and I worked with her in both of her cookbooks, so that's how we met.
Yeah.
My father's daughter, it's all good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a very specific lifestyle, both that collection as well as Goop. What did you learn about being more curatorial of your work by dealing with those two projects?
You mean about what part of the work?
Well, how you take either a personality or, you mm-hmm. know, a subject and really refine that rather mm-hmm. than say, you know, I like this Brazilian food, I'm going to cook it. Like, how do you bring in the reins?
Right, okay.
I mean, I feel like in all the work I do, including my experience working on those books, I think food is such a huge topic, and I, especially in writing, I feel like there shouldn't ever be a recipe in a cookbook that doesn't come from a really authentic place. And
yeah.
as we were just talking about Cleo and I sort of starting the work we do together based on like the meals we actually cook together and coming from this really real experience of something we enjoy, I feel like in my experience working with a number of people on their books, you know, I don't want anything in a person's book that doesn't represent them and isn't really true to them. And, you know, a recipe should never fill space just
yeah.
because it like fits in the category. And it, and I was really lucky to work with Gwyneth on those books early on, because I think all of the recipes are super true to her, and especially her first book, My Father's Daughter, is like, it's a very nostalgic book, and
mm-hmm.
there's great stories attached to everything, and it's, yeah, those lessons about sort of curating, I think, have come through.
Yeah, and I think she remains very true to herself and what she puts out there. And when I was working with Goop, it was always, we're only going to put out content that I really believe in. And I think that's a really good lesson that has carried us through too in our own work. And I think, yeah, authenticity and making sure that even if it's something that you're doing your own take on, that you say that, and you don't have to be the world's expert in,
yeah.
you know, French cuisine. It's your own and personal take on it. And you might not be, you know.
Yeah, I've always thought it's interesting that you can't copyright a recipe. So
yeah.
it's, you know, it's like, you know, 1,000 cookbooks are telling you how to make, like, whatever, spaghetti with tomato sauce, and it's like you're not going to figure out who, like, invented that or take credit for it. It's like something we all love for a really good reason because it's, like, delicious. So it's just whatever your
version
is. And
it's also always a little different every time.
Yeah, that is a really interesting point because you can't even copyright like a process.
Exactly.
Unless it's a manufactured process. Yeah. Which is a whole nother debate on, you know, why it's an open sharing community or should be in the culinary world versus commercial food world. But we'll gloss over that. Jump back into collaboration because, Julia, I know you're doing a couple other cookbooks, Bouvette with Jody Williams at the time. How do you collaborate but keep your own voice? And this will lead into how the two of you work together as well.
I mean, that's a really good question. I feel like my, in that, it's weird because my work, I do like a number of different things. And when I try to sum it all up, it's hard to put one word to it. So I feel like when I do that kind of work, which is working with other people on their books, and that can mean a number of things like developing and testing recipes or just sort of project managing or sometimes doing writing or, you know, whatever it might be. I think in terms of staying true to my voice, it's interesting because it's usually about staying true to someone else's and making sure that they have whatever tools they need to accurately convey their voice and their story through their cookbook. And so maybe it's spending time in their kitchen with them and watching them cook, which was like working on that with Jody Williams for the Bouvette book was like one of the best experiences I've had, just watching her cook. And
you don't even have to be in the kitchen for that one. You can just sit at the bar.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Her kitchen extends. And you know, most of that for me is just like helping put people on a really good schedule, so that they can turn their books around on time and making sure that they have enough time and space to comfortably tell their stories.
When the micromanaging
but it's so being, you know, involved with cookbooks as well, it's so ultimately necessary.
Oh, totally.
And when there isn't a person like that on
it unravels.
Yeah, absolutely. The Fat Radish book as well. Now it comes to Weird and Ravenous. Now, this is a point where you two get to have your own voice and get to express your own ideas. And, you know, I was looking at a lot of the Food 52 videos that you guys do, and it's very, you know, almost Bob Dylan, subterranean blues, cue cards with you know, this great flush of music. But then there are things, you know, that are out of the ordinary. The kale and lucuma shake. Like, lucuma, and I find myself...
I think we just love the word.
Yeah, no, I do too. I'm like,
say lucuma. We also spelled it wrong so many times. We had to do that one card
which times. Which doesn't sound like a big deal until you've, like, edited and uploaded that video, and then all of a sudden you realize that you have to redo the whole thing.
You're like, are you kidding me? All right, okay.
Back everyone, to the anyway, yeah, everyone knows kale now, but why should we know lucuma?
I think it's just fun to find, like you said, unexpected ingredients that people don't really know about, superfood, so to speak. I think it draws a certain audience, a curious audience, and there's always, you always want to sort of put things out there that people are go, huh, what's that, you know?
We're always looking for the other weird and ravenous people.
Yeah, exactly. So those are, you know, it's a really healthy ingredient. It's full of lots of different vitamins and minerals, and you know, it was time for lucuma to have its due.
Yeah. What other ingredients wouldn't I know? This isn't a test on myself, but it's just what have you found? And you're like, wow, it's just time to shine for something like lucuma.
I mean, this isn't a new ingredient. You probably know it, but I've just been recently obsessed with it because of one of our best friends, Amelia. She was turning me on to Aleppo pepper.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it's not new, but it's so good, and I've literally been putting it on everything recently.
You know, and I go to a pizza shop, and they have that stale, you know, old, crappy, dried pepper.
No.
And if there was, you know, like Aleppo or like Urfa Bibir, other kinds of flavors brought in.
Yeah. Or I'm just looking, I mean, we're at Roberta, so I'm just looking at the table now. Like, if you just heat it up with oil and, like, bring it back to life a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't take much, but...
I'm trying to think of other fun ingredients.
Well, I mean, just the concept of combinations, too. The sweet potato, what is it, coconut and cinnamon.
Yeah. I'm a big believer in just really smart combinations of food that aren't like to, you know, draw attention that isn't necessary or anything, you know, not any just combinations for shock value's sake, but I think there's just so much stuff that you can do really simply, but by, you know, approaching it smartly and just combining, if it's sweet potatoes with coconut oil, which is like, we were, that whole series for Food 52, we were trying to make really healthy food that wasn't like boring at all.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It's that those combinations, I think, really come into play when you're trying to smartly make vegetables that you want to be really flavorful.
And are really satisfying. And like coconut oil is like such a great fat to cook with. And I think especially in, that was a fun one because we roasted those and then we sort of talked about all different ways you could use them. And so you can throw them onto a salad or you can just like add, you know, whether like coconut milk or stock and make a soup or I think we had a few other ideas and like eating them with oatmeal and stuff. And now I'm getting hungry. And so I think it's nice when you can do something really simply and then all of a sudden you realize how much variety you can get from one thing. And you know, so it doesn't have to be difficult at all.
So you obviously cook together a lot, but what do you cook for yourselves separately?
Well, Cleo was just starting to tell me about what she made last night, which sounded so good.
Last night I made I made ramen, which I never make, but I was having this total food sensory memory from when I was 13 years old, and one of the this girl in my class was actually she was Mexican, so she usually brought a lot of Mexican food, but she also would bring cup of noodles to school and then heat it up in the microwave but add a ton of lemon and hot sauce, and it was so delicious.
I feel like you've talked about this for years.
it's so good, and I had this, I was like, I need to make that. So I had ramen, but I actually,
it's like ramen michelada.
It was so, but you know what, it was, it's a really interesting thing because you think of ramen as being this very Asian flavor, but you kind of bring in this Mexican hot spiciness, citrus flavor. And it's, and I added some spinach and bok choy, so it wasn't exactly like I had it when I was 13. So but
speaking of ingredients, do you know yuzu kosho?
Well, yuzu. What's the
kosho is a pepper. So it's like this citrus and pepper blend. It's kind of like a paste that you put in.
I think Cleo needs that.
I use it for ramens every once in a while because you need a little bit of brightness. Yes. I love umami, but I like acidity.
I'm a big fan of the lift at the end. Yeah. Like putting so acid much lemon or chili delicious. Or both on anything.
Well, I will be incorporating.
It was. I'm telling you,
my diet for sure.
And I feel like Julie is the queen of the egg.
Anything with
the egg for one.
Every leftover heated up with an egg on top, and I'm like so happy and hot sauce.
Fried, poached,
anything, everything, all of the above.
Egg in a hole
is that's probably the one thing I do make. Like just for myself, and I started making that in London, and it's weird because I think that's like a really homey thing that people, it's always like, oh, my mom made that for me, and like my mom never made that for me. I started making it for myself when I was like 25.
What is toad in a hole in London?
Oh, so toad in a hole is like where you like have sausages and then you pour over like that popover batter, and then it you know, I heard the funniest thing, but this was just like egg in a hole, like where you cut out the egg and fry it. Someone actually Ben from the Fat Radish, we did a toad in the hole recipe in their book, which won't be out for like another year, but we're just working on it. And he was saying, if when you put that in the oven, the whole point is that that really hot pan and the batter combine, and then that like burst of heat makes it puff up like immediately, and it's just like a popover. But if you put it in the oven and it doesn't do that, but it's like still totally edible, it's just like not impressive, then you're supposed to call it frog in a bog.
That's funny.
You just come up with a new name and then you're fine.
I love it. I love that. Reinvention.
There you go.
I love that. That's
frog in a bog.
So, I mean, something as simple as eggs reminds me of what you guys are doing for Medium right now. Mm. And, you know, it's these short, prosy, poetic pieces about, oh, that was quite the alliteration. grilled cheese.
Yeah.
Something as, and how it sates a person, but how people interact with, you know, that subject. Can you tell me why grilled cheese was one of the many foci?
Well, the title for it came about, I mean, it's the series of interviewing families and just what their totally typical family dinner routine is. And it was funny because when we would get in touch with people to do it, it was always like whatever you would normally be doing on whatever night we would go over Wednesday night.
Don't make something special.
Dress up. Don't, you know, none of that. And And so the one of the criteria for the families that we chose to interview was hopefully families who had young children, just to give it some unifying factor. And so the name was just calling it Grilled Cheese Please. It's like what kids ask for when they don't want, you know, other foods. And it was actually really amazing to see that. But that whole, we interviewed 12 families, and I thought it was like all those kids ate like the same as their parents. And
yeah, it was really, really great to see. And unexpected, mm-hmm. I think, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
That there wasn't a lot of catering to, we thought there were going to be a lot more picky eaters, but or like, on a whole,
there would be more grilled cheese, and there wasn't.
No.
Yeah.
Exactly. Maybe we just interviewed very, you know, cultivated families. But
what were some of the more surprising dishes you saw the children eat?
That's a fun question.
The last one we did was a great recipe for green pasta, which had a great sort of story behind it, which is that she tells her kids that the Incredible
And the mother
Hulk,
is Peruvian.
Yeah, Peruvian, yeah. Half Peruvian, half Chinese. Mm-hmm. That the tells the kids that if they eat it, they'll grow big and strong like the Incredible Hulk, which always, it's fun if you can
which
get
if they're
a gimmick
listening
in there.
Is true.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And it was sort of like a pesto, but she added a little bit of cream cheese and feta to make it a little bit richer, a little bit creamier.
Salty. It was delicious.
And it was delicious. And the kids love it. And they have it once a week. And I think that's another thing. It's like once you get something down that kids love, you can do it once or twice a week and they'll still, you know, they don't care that much about variety.
And it's cool because I think we're at a point where we're like spending a lot of time thinking about things we loved growing up and like the ramen that you had, you know, and it's fun to spend a little time with these families and visit them and watch them, you know, like these kids will probably make that when they're older and it'll, like, remind them of home and all that. So it's really sweet.
And so it seems like all the things you guys do underneath the titular Weird and Ravenous is to propagate these familiar experiences that people can share with one another based around food. Is there an end goal? Are there other projects spawning off of Weird and Ravenous? Or
to
is
take
it
take over the world.
It all starts here.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's always been, it's kind of, to go back to what we were saying earlier about keeping work really sort of authentic and true to your story and everything, the work that Cleo and I have always done together has always been sort of stuff like on top of our day jobs, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it's like never, you know, it's always going to be work that we do because we love it and not because we like have to do it. And I think for us, it's just been about finding like great stories and great people and, you know, and the recipes that come with all that. So,
yeah.
That's it. That's that dead air that we love here in the video. Yeah.
The goal is to take over Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Oh,
and
thank
I
you.
Will continue reading all your explorations and food and family. But there's one thing I kind of ask of the two of you. You know, the way that you bring together a community, the way that you have people cook together is a very interactive thing. You two are not shy people. And not that you need social media to be out there, but I just wish more people knew about Weird and Ravenous. I'm hoping to help that.
Yeah, thank
but you. But I think what you're doing has to be something that needs to be both seen and heard.
We're terrible at social media. We're so bad. And we shouldn't be because we are the social media generation and we suck at it.
It's amazing. But when you see
someone, we don't even know what a Google Hangout is.
With such talent and humility, it is a great thing to see. But then, you know, sometimes you got to light the fire under the ass. And
I know.
Hopefully I can do that a little for you.
Thank you.
Because I really think everything you guys are doing are very necessary to share.
Well, thank you.
So,
yeah.
That means a lot. Thanks so much.
Weird and Ravenous, Julie and Cleo, thank you so much for being
on. Thanks for having us.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.